fentanyl really changed the game. This is an epidemic. This is a crisis. What we had been doing wasn't working. This is more than a homelessness crisis. It's an intersecting homelessness, behavioral health, and drug addiction crisis. We need to bring our healthcare system and our social service system in closer alignment. We need to reorient our public health strategies to not only support those in crisis, but to think about the broader communities.
Welcome to The Other 80. I'm Claudia Williams. San Francisco spends almost $1 billion a year on its response to homelessness. I want you to let that really sink in. $1 billion. And even with that very large spend, the number of people experiencing homelessness has gone up, not down. Mayor Daniel Lurie campaigned on his willingness to boldly rethink the city's approach. And now Kunal Modi is leading the charge as San Francisco's Chief of Health and Human Services. He joins me to talk about how San Francisco plans to tackle the intersecting issues that drive the homeless problem in the city: serious mental illness, fentanyl and meth addiction, and the affordable housing crisis. So please welcome Kunal Modi to The Other 80. It's so wonderful to have you on the show. And I wanted to start with a recognition of your volunteer service as an AmeriCorps. I was a Peace Corps volunteer, so have a lot of affinity for people who choose that community and public service early in their careers.
Well, I think the AmeriCorps program really spoke to me. I was an AmeriCorps VISTA. I was interested in being on the ground, working with folks who were trying to make their lives better and the folks who were trying to help them, but also thinking about systems change. And so I was placed in Washington, D.C. I was working with an organization called Lyft Communities. It was both a very inspiring and a very sobering year. You know, I learned when the systems and programs and policies come together with a person who's really motivated and someone that's sitting beside them to guide them, the impact is extraordinary and people can really achieve all the transformative change that we hope for. And 8 times out of 10, that didn't happen because the form was too clunky, the appointment was missed for some reason, the two programs' eligibility criteria didn't tie. And so it really shaped my outlook. When I thought about what I wanted to do with my career, I wanted to flip those odds. Like, I wanted to make sure that 1 or 2 times out of 10, that those things all came together, became 8 or 9 times out of 10. And so I never thought at a young age I'd be getting into the weeds of bureaucratic system redesign and administrative burden reduction. And yet that became something that I increasingly found myself drawn to and trying to figure out.
I spent a lot of my work and career on Medicaid, Medi-Cal, and I think we were in a big phase of expansion and thinking about bigger benefits, more benefits. And I think now with the cuts, there's been a lot of focus on actually the system wasn't working that well. And how do we go back to the drawing board and use this opportunity of disruption to rethink? And with that, I think the other term I wanted to bring this conversation to at the beginning is really what Mayor Lurie ran on, which is accountability. You have a very expansive role, but we're going to be focusing on mostly the sort of breaking the cycle combination of public safety, homelessness, and mental health. As you think about that word accountability, which I think is used often, but is sometimes not very meaningful, what does that really mean for how you're approaching your work?
San Franciscans are rightly asking themselves, I know I did, that's partly what motivated me to take this role of, we spend almost $1 billion on this crisis every year. There's a lot of work happening, and yet the number of people who seem to be in crisis on our streets seems to be the same. And in some ways, over the past couple of years, it feels like it maybe has even gotten worse. And so accountability means that taxpayers are entrusting us with a lot of resources. San Francisco is a well-resourced city and county. How is that actually helping to not only bring people indoors, but make sure that they get the care that they need to actually stabilize and over time recover? And I think we've spent this past year really trying to re-anchor on those things. What problems are we trying to solve? How will we know if we're on the right track? And then how do we regularly reflect upon whether we're making that progress and have the humility to change course if we're not?
And that's a great segue to talk about what is being called by you, by the mayor, by others, breaking the cycle. Meaning, how do we actually take that $1 billion of investment and shift so we get different outcomes? And I want to just pause there and ask, can you describe in a little bit more concrete detail what things weren't working and what are the things you're curious about trying that you think might produce a different result?
Well, I think first we have to get really clear on what problem are we actually trying to solve? Because we as a community broadly use the term homelessness, but the challenges that any of us see when we walk down Market Street or through the Tenderloin are more complex than homelessness. It's the behavioral mental health crisis. It's the drug addiction crisis and how fentanyl in particular, alongside meth, really changed the game over the past 5 years. It's the broader affordable housing crisis and how all of these intersect. And so what we really did was reorient our focus on what, you know, we heard from San Franciscans is the number one priority, which is the number of people who are clearly on our streets in crisis at the intersection of those different challenges. And when you start to look at it through that lens and you say, okay, those are the folks that we want to really double down our focus on. What had gone wrong previously was we were taking a very homelessness first lens and under resourcing, not focusing enough on the mental health and drug addiction side of it. And so when you have someone in that condition, you need a lot more than a roof to stabilize. You actually need the right support services and structure to help you break fentanyl addiction. And so we are investing much more to make our system of response in homelessness look like a health system that's integrated across health services, social services, emergency responders, partnerships with law enforcement, so that we're bringing in people indoors, being really clear-eyed around the level of clinical and behavioral health supports they need, staffing those sites appropriately, and working with our commercial partners too, healthcare providers, emergency room directors, so that we're thinking of this as a system of care. We had not really focused enough on flow. So people were getting stuck in our system. So it felt like we were spending a lot of money, but we weren't achieving the outcomes that we all wanted. And so those have been some of the big shifts that we've started to make over this past year that we're going to keep building upon.
Harm reduction was the approach that said, listen, before somebody's ready for addiction treatment, they need clean clothes, they need a safe place to sleep, et cetera. And that it's an iterative process. You kind of meet people where they are. And I think there's been some reads of some of the policy changes that have said, is that no longer our approach? Other reads have said, well, the approach to harm reduction wasn't working. It was meeting people where they were, but it wasn't actually moving where they were. So I'd love to just sit in that question. It's not an easy question. It's not a simple one.
Yeah.
Is this a shift in how we're thinking about or the focus on harm reduction, or is it not?
Well, we are certainly making shifts. I would say I have found over the course of this past year, people like to debate labels a lot and they become very newsy. So I'm less worried about what we're moving away from and more what we're moving towards. There sometimes is this belief of, well, if we just provide temporary housing, then people will be indoors. It's like, no, but if people are dealing with schizophrenia, with psychosis, with incredibly hard to break addiction to fentanyl or meth, they will be out there on 6th Street in the Tenderloin. And it's a challenge to both themselves and the whole community. And so we need to be really clear-eyed about the types of supports people really need. We need to be thoughtful around strategies that worked really well through the AIDS crisis, through previous generations of drugs, and to say fentanyl really changed the game and it's different. And so we need to update our thinking. And I think, you know, we stand on the shoulders of so many public health practitioners who had to update our approaches in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s on how we combated various public health challenges. When we came into office, it was roughly two people a day who were dying of a drug overdose. This is an epidemic. This is a crisis. And so what we had been doing wasn't working. And so we're going to try something different. We'll learn as we go. We're going to try and be smart and responsible and evidence-based in the way that we do it so that we are investing in things like medicated-assisted treatment. We're investing in structure and support to help people through their addiction. I'm actually really proud of the way our team has been on the leading edge of street-based telemedicine to get direct access to a prescription for buprenorphine or methadone. Our treatment starts are up over 50% year over year. And we have a lot more work to do to ensure that those retention rates get higher. But I don't worry too much about labels like harm reduction or otherwise. I think it's about just using common sense evidence and being clear-eyed about the problems that exist today and what are the strategies we need to actually make the most impact.
When you think about that really compelling vision you outlined to say somebody who's addicted, who's using fentanyl every day, you can't just provide them housing, whatever that housing is. You need a lot of wraparound services. Are those services already existing, but they need to be reorganized? Or is there a lot of additional capacity that's needed, especially in addiction treatment and mental health?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both, but in a lot of ways, a lot of new capacity. And what we're doing this work in the context of a multi-decade change that had been occurring. So if we want to zoom way out and do 6-7 decades of history in 2 or 3 minutes, the way to really think about this is, you know, we live in a state that for a long time hasn't built enough affordable housing. We live in a state that many decades ago started alongside nationally deinstitutionalized state mental health hospitals. We have a national context in which the commercial boarding care, assisted living, skilled nursing facility industries have been under commercial duress. And you've seen a lot of those mom and pop operators go out of business. And then obviously permanent supportive housing emerged late 80s, early 90s, and really scaled through the 2000s to become sort of the backstop for an affordable housing ecosystem that hadn't produced enough units for a healthcare sector that was kind of flatlining in terms of board and care and assisted living. And the acuity that folks were experiencing because of growing mental health challenges and drug addiction was going up. Our kind of modern homelessness response system as we know it in San Francisco in the early 2000s that really emerged, or late 90s, early 2000s, was built on the backs of a lot of our social service partners, church groups that were serving kind of a deindustrializing country, alcoholism, job loss. And now over 50% of folks in our system of care have a serious mental illness or a drug addiction. It's a very different demographic, but our response has been largely the same. A bunch of place-based sites operated with social service partners. And so what really the state has been doing over the past couple of years through CalAIM, through Prop 1, is to really start to re-architect that gap that was left when the state hospital system started to diminish. And so we have a lot of work to do. This is a multi-decade challenge in the making and won't get addressed overnight. Our macro focus is the right level of care for people's needs and to really be disciplined about that so that we're not bringing people indoors only for them to suffer, because then we've actually, you know, not set them up for success, which is not only a bad human outcome, but it wasn't an efficient use of our limited funding, which is to give them the best shot at success.
I'm going to ask about new initiatives or new approaches that happened over the last year, each of which I think is a vignette into your approach. The first is reorganizing the street response teams. This was something that I think across the board, folks have just been really excited about and took what you started with in this conversation, which was about the fragmentation of government, the experience not being what we want. So talk about what it is you did and why you did it and what's happened as a result.
When the mayor took office, there was 9 different outreach teams across 7 different departments, and each saw a part of the challenge that a single person was experiencing. And what that meant was you'd have someone who would maybe get encountered by a social worker as a member of our homeless outreach team, but they have an open wound. And they said, well, before we can talk about housing, we need to get that taken care of. So let me call someone from street medicine. And then maybe that person would show up 2 hours later, and maybe that person had moved by then. Or sometimes you would come upon someone who was ready to move inside, but the right person who did that eligibility wasn't there. And so what we found was, again, each department has a part of the response, but we need to show up as a more integrated city, like a Swiss Army knife, so that we're meeting the person in front of us and really understanding their needs and very quickly able to deploy the set of services or resources to help that person get to where they need to be. And so what we did was we created one citywide structure. We call it our neighborhood street teams. We divided the city into 5 zones. Each neighborhood has an outreach led, and we put this under our Department of Emergency Management because we want to approach this like the crisis that it is. And that lead coordinates resources across homelessness, supportive housing, Department of Public Health, Department of Public Works, police, fire, street crisis response teams, community paramedicine, so that we can more quickly get people indoors. Since we've implemented this model, we've had a 40% increase in our speed of shelter placement. We've also expanded our street health operations. So we've expanded telehealth operations 16 hours a day, so that people who are in the throes of addiction but ready to make a change can quickly get a prescription for whether it's buprenorphine or methadone or some of the solutions to help begin to break an opioid addiction. So that's been a big plus. And then we've actually brought tent encampments down to a record low since San Francisco started measuring the count by over a third, even in the past 12 months. And so it's definitely been a huge change that has helped us really improve our ability to get to people in crisis quickly on the streets and bring them indoors in the right level of care for them.
I can also imagine if I'm somebody in one of those teams, it's frustrating when you see that things aren't delivering the results that people need. And I can imagine there's just a really virtuous cycle of workplace satisfaction that comes when you see that the system is organized in a way that can deliver on your mission. Fragmentation, nobody likes that. It's just what results from people not really architecting the system in the right way.
Someone observed to me once that the biggest victims of bureaucracy are those who are in it. Mm-hmm, and totally. I think that is so true in this response model. And so to your point, I think it's been very motivating for the teams to feel like they actually have a quick call or connect to the person who can help the person in front of them if they don't have all the solutions themselves.
My boss was Todd Park at the White House. Yeah. And he famously was asked by the president to go fix healthcare.gov. And one of the first things that Mikey Dickerson did was said, we need someone from CMS who's a decision maker who can come be on site at the response center to be able to lessen the expanse between the decision maker and the decision and really empower people on the front lines.
I think that's spot on and a great observation. I mean, I learned this from my corporate career as well. You have to set clear goals and expectations, but then delegate decisioning closer to your front line. And so folks feel empowered to make decisions, and you ensure you have the right protocols and governance and reporting in place so that you can learn from those decisions. But we want people to take our outreach workers to take chances, to try things, to they're the closest to the folks that they're serving. This is really complex, hard work, trying to partner with someone and build a relationship with someone who's been living on the street a long time or may need help, but may not seek it out themselves. How do you work with them, build that rapport, and actually help bring them indoors? How do you have the discipline to know, you know, this is now crossed into a public safety concern and I actually need to be able to call our partners in the police department? So those are very complicated and hard questions. And it's building that trust with our frontline workers to be able to increasingly make those decisions and to have their back when they take risks. We have a dashboard that we look at. We get together every Friday and we reflect on the week together. There's a daily stand-up in the morning about what the priorities are for the day. And so this is meant to be a learning system where we're operating more like a scrum team that's doing outreach than a fixed model where we hope it just works well.
The second policy decision, which is fairly recent, was the decision to ban RV parking beyond 2 hours. Again, could you describe what the goal was of this change and how that's going and the nuances of that policy? Because I think people view that as a very black and white thing. Yeah. What are you trying to accomplish and how are you doing it?
Well, we're rooted in the belief that no child is well served growing up in a vehicle instead of in housing. And so we have hundreds of RVs and large vehicles across San Francisco, some of whom are families who are priced out of housing in San Francisco, many who are from other jurisdictions who are parked in San Francisco, maybe looking for opportunity, or we have lots of streets throughout our city that are without any kind of parking protocol around them. And so we wanted to achieve two things fundamentally. One was to help move more families out of what we think is generally kind of an unsafe and unsanitary living condition for a long duration. Many of these RVs are running on external generators, don't have access to sewage, and so are dumping wastewater, have security issues, and so want to move them into housing. And second is we actually have to think about how we support public spaces and the public realm. I mean, RVs in front of small businesses in neighborhoods sometimes do disrupt the broader community. And we have, a big shift in our administration is recentering that public health means the whole public, both those who are in crisis who we want to support humanely and those in our general public who also deserve safe sidewalks and clean streets. And so we were trying to find that balance. The reason we were able to build a coalition that finally got this piece of legislation passed was we did invest a lot of new funding to make sure that every family in an RV had a pathway to housing, but that we also created a new citywide parking restriction that meant our neighborhoods also wouldn't be dotted with RVs that were kind of disrupting from the broader community. It's funny, I think about in San Francisco how we have all these pitched battles for years around ADUs and backyards, and yet we had kind of no governance over what is effectively an ADU in a public street. You know, we don't believe vehicles are meant to be permanent housing, and we recognize many families are struggling, so that's why we also invested in the pathways to housing to bring them indoors. So we think we found the right balance between both supporting people in crisis and supporting our neighborhoods who are looking for better answers.
I'm wondering if there's another policy where you came in to the over a year ago thinking there was one solution and maybe the thinking has shifted over the course of the last year.
Some of the core hypotheses I think we've generally continued to believe in and validate that this is more than a homelessness crisis. It's an intersecting homelessness, behavioral health, and drug addiction crisis, that we need to bring our healthcare system and our social service system in closer alignment, and that we need to reorient our public health strategies to not only support those in crisis, but to think about the broader communities and neighborhoods. I think those were kind of core convictions that we've continued to hold on to that guide our policies. And then, of course, interventions we try, initiatives we advance are constantly tweaking based on what we learn.
I love that focus on public health. And for me, and from the other 80 perspective, what that means is thinking deeply about the underlying drivers. As you think about these intersecting crises of homelessness, mental health, and addiction, what are the prevention strategies that you're trying or interested in investing in that do go upstream from the problem we see on the streets?
It's a great question. And it's, I think many will tell you the most high impact thing you can do is prevent homelessness in the first place, or mental health crisis or addiction. And the longer that someone is on the streets, the more complicated the challenges they face become, and the more complex their clinical condition becomes. And so it becomes even harder. And so we are very focused on upstream efforts. There's three in particular. The first is for those who are low-income San Franciscans who are increasingly facing financial pressure just because of our own rental market locally, and also given all the federal cuts that are going to impact people's access to health coverage, to food benefits, and other supports, is how do we think about emergency cash assistance, rental assistance, legal supports to keep people housed in a way that is targeted and helps people weather certain crises. The second is to be more clear-eyed around when we encounter someone in crisis who is in our emergency room or otherwise, that we're really getting a full 360 view of who that person is and what their needs are. When you take that lens, it's not uncommon that we'll find that, oh, the person in front of us actually had their Medicaid coverage in Merced County. They ended up in a San Francisco emergency room because of X, Y, Z reasons. And actually the best thing we can do for their long-term stability is support them to get reunited with their family, a home where they have a social support structure that can help them stabilize and succeed. And so really trying to understand someone's clinical presentation and their full story so that we can get them, instead of just assuming, oh, you're all of a sudden on an escalator through San Francisco's systems. It's like, no, let's actually understand their needs and think about, sometimes it does mean placement within our system of care, and sometimes it means elsewhere. And then the last thing is to shift our system of care more towards the front end interim housing solutions. We as a city had really invested in low barrier shelters and then permanent supportive housing, sort of a barbell approach. And the reality is a lot of people with the right supports in the first 24 hours, 14 days, 60 days, 90 days can actually get back on their feet and stabilize. And so we're really trying to think about what are those interventions on the upfront that we can really double down on to help people quickly re-enroll in public benefits that they may not have been taking advantage of, workforce programs, think about medication starts. Now, obviously, many people in crisis, it's a much longer road. And so we completely recognize that in those systems of longer term care, if they're to catch those individuals and ensure that they're supported. But as much as possible, have a mindset of like, how quickly can we get you back on your feet and supported is something that we're really trying to orient on.
And I remember reading the big homelessness study that Margot Koshal and her colleagues did, which found that a lot of the mental health and addiction issues were pre-existing perhaps, but are exacerbated by the time on the street, including needing to protect yourself, or including, you know, all of these different things. So that you could imagine if you thought that people had profound mental health and addiction issues, regardless of their housing, then it wouldn't make as much sense to focus on the interim housing. But understanding that there's that interplay between those things means that getting in early with both mental health supports and housing is a path to a different trajectory.
That's right.
And also that the number one and two approaches you just highlighted are both eminently covered by CalAIM, right?
Right.
And so you have a funding source that's right in front of you that it's actually been underutilized in a lot of counties and cities. But if with the right structures, you can completely tap that, because that is about the interim solutions and helping in the crisis versus the longer term.
I think when people think about homelessness, they quickly think about shelters and nonprofits. They don't really think as much around emergency rooms and drug addiction rehab or Medi-Cal funded benefits. And so it's kind of reorienting and saying, you know, when you take a primary health lens to this and think about how do you support people through their complex needs, knowing that housing social services is part of that stabilization for many people, but actually we need to treat sort of the root challenges that people have from a healthcare practitioner standpoint, you can actually achieve different outcomes.
I'm so excited to see how this evolves. I want to spend a minute on the specific organizational structure that you're sitting in. You are joined by colleagues who are also in this similar policy chief role. They're sort of deputy roles to the mayor that help bundle areas of policy intervention in a way that the mayor could not be accountable to, you know, the 50 or 100 different organizations. What do you think is making that work or will make that structure work? And how is that organization going? Because it's a bit different in this last year.
Well, it's a big change. And I think to the mayor's great credit, one of the first things he did when he got elected was restructure the mayor's office. As you noted, San Francisco's city and county had over 50 departments that basically reported directly to the mayor and chief of staff. And when you have 50 plus departments reporting to a single executive, it's a recipe to focus on kind of immediate crises or the issue of the day and not the long-term structural work that's often needed to reform systems and ensure they're working properly day to day. And so he created this structure that many other cities had, but we had not had here in San Francisco, to have these chief models. So it's myself as chief of health and human services, my colleagues, the chief of housing and economic development, the chief of infrastructure, climate, mobility, chief of public safety, and chief of strategy and performance. And we each partner with a portfolio of departments that are trying to tackle a set of challenges that are citywide priorities, but don't fall neatly within the purview of one department. And so in my work, I partner with the Department of Public Health, Homeless Supportive Housing, our Human Services Agency, which is the county's, our benefits administrator for Medicaid, SNAP, TANF, and so forth, Department of Early Childhood, Children, Youth, and Families. With my colleagues, I'm able to kind of interact with them because there are many things, obviously, in housing and economic development that relate to health and human services, same with infrastructure. And so we have to partner closely together to be able to deliver ultimately the mayor's priorities. The mayor has been very clear since he started on what his main priorities are. Public safety, number one, tackling the behavioral health and addiction crisis, number two, stewarding our economic revitalization, both in downtown and support for small businesses, number three, and the fourth, just making government work, have it be accountable, responsive, citizen-centered. And so those have been our priorities. And I think our job is to make sure that the work that each department, and I've met so many incredible, talented folks that work on our team here throughout our departments, but making sure they have clarity on what the mayor's kind of North Star vision are, how departments work together to advance that vision, and what their particular roles are. I actually just came this morning. We have a weekly Breaking the Cycle meeting. So it's not just a tagline, it's actually a governance structure. We had the department heads across, public health, homelessness, emergency management, disability and aging services, mayor's office of housing, all around the table discussing how we're going to improve the care model in our different systems of care. And so that work is prompting a lot of departmental collaboration that doesn't naturally happen on its own in these types of bureaucracies. And so I think if anything, my role in the model the mayor set up is intended to do that, to create a flatter government that works more seamlessly together so that we're not showing up to residents as the Department of X and Department of Y, but like the city of San Francisco in a more integrated way.
Having hosted some of those kinds of collaborations from the White House, so one of the first human reaction is I'm getting called to the principal's office on a weekly basis now, right? And I think skilled leadership can really switch that to like, I'm your ultimate backstop and I can help solve problems for you because we can manage resources, manage communication in a way that the thing that you've been grappling with that no one seemed to be able to help you solve, now you have a pathway to solve that. I've seen it from both angles and I think it can shift to something really powerful and collaborative if it's really seen as not just like a hammer, but a whole set of tools that everybody can use.
I think that's spot on and a great observation. I mean, a lot of what we're trying to do through the administration is not just, you know, one or two big policy objectives. It is really changing the way government works and to be more holistic and citizen-centered. And so that really is systems change work. And that is not going to be achieved through some top-down edict. That's going to be about culture and investment in our frontline and empowering people to bring problems that they're facing to those forums and actually work with their peers to tackle them together.
And I hope one small benefit of this conversation will be inspiring people to come join your cause. These moments of change are not common and can create decades of impact. And so if other people are out there who have thought, I might enjoy time in public service, this is the time to raise your hand and figure out how to be part of it.
Come join us. I mean, we're really fired up about what's happening in San Francisco right now. We really do feel like a city on the rise. We've got great wind at our back from the first year in office. We've got, you know, crime at record low. We're getting more people connected to treatment. Our businesses are really coming back to life. We've obviously got the AI boom taking root in our backyard while we're still focused on how do we continue to make San Francisco more affordable for working families. And so there's lots of big problems to solve. But we think if we can show that we can tackle some of those big thorny challenges in San Francisco can be a blueprint for so many other jurisdictions to learn from. And we can ultimately help so many of our residents continue to stay in San Francisco, live here, thrive here. I mean, I got into this because my wife and I have our three young kids and I want San Francisco to be the community that they and their friends deserve as they grow up. And I know we all want that for the next generation. So it's a really exciting time. So I'll echo your call. If you're fired up about what we're trying to do, come drop us a line and we want you to be a part of it.
Well, I will close out with two quick questions, which have to do with this theme of January and yes, the new year. The first is, what's something you're just really curious about right now?
There's obviously so many advances in AI and technology and how we can use those tools to really improve our workflows, our systems, to get better outcomes for this work. I mean, when we think about Medi-Cal billing, when we think about eligibility forms, when we think about helping people with the new administrative requirements through SNAP and Medi-Cal, how do we use this moment of all these new tools and solutions to actually help people very practically stay enrolled in their health coverage and their food assistance coverage to work through forms to do better billing? And so I think less on the chatbot side and more on the true workflow side, how do we take all of the great innovation happening in our backyard and help improve our health and social services systems?
And last, is there an experience or lesson from last year that really is sticking with you?
I think what sticks with me, we've talked about so many systems change work and I'm sitting here in a suit and I'm in City Hall, but you know, that's not where this work lives, and not to forget what it's really about, which is folks and communities that are struggling, not just the people in crisis, but the business owner in the tenderloin who's can't stay open late because street conditions are too adverse. It's thinking about their stories and thinking about all this work that we do, actually having to move the ball forward for them in a very tangible way in the near term. So to not get lost in all the heady strategy and systems change work, that you lose sight of the very human impact. And so those stories really stick with me.
Well, Kunal, thank you so much for joining. It's been a pleasure. It's very inspiring to hear you talk about what's happening. I'm just across the bay in Berkeley and feel very proud that we have the kind of commitment you represent and the innovation and the change and really using the incredibly powerful levers of government to make the world a better place.
Well, thank you for having me, Claudia. I really appreciate the time and having a chance to trade notes with you.
There's one important point I think Kunal really drove home. If we want to change outcomes in San Francisco or in other cities facing similar challenges, a new program or line item is not going to move the needle. We need new working models. This includes a culture of accountability and a system designed around the people, not bureaucracy. It's about helping individuals in crisis, but also providing clean, safe streets so working families will stay and thrive in the city we love. Figuring out how to serve both at once is how San Francisco will move forward. This podcast was created by me, Claudia Williams. My podcast producer is Avery Moore-Kloss. Check out the show notes for more information on Kunal Modi and his work in San Francisco. There's more information on my background, this podcast, and our guests on our website, www.theother80.com. Until next time, I'm Claudia Williams.